And good afternoon. Welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it. Before we begin today, this news from Baltimore City Hall, which broke yesterday afternoon. After only 6 months on the job, Kamer Marshall has stepped down as the director of communications for Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott. The circumstances of his abrupt departure are not clear. Marshall told Fox 45 News that he was not fired, and he issued a statement praising Scott and wishing him well. Marshall had recently expanded the mayor's communications team to include several Democratic Party operatives from Washington. Mr. Scott has made a number of appearances in national media in recent weeks. The position of communications director in both Scott administrations has been something of a revolving door. Since 2021, Marshall has been one of five people to hold the position in addition to two acting communications directors. And today it's midday on the law. Last week, the bulk of President Donald Trump's domestic agenda was narrowly passed by Republicans in Congress. It extended the tax cuts passed 10 years ago. It decimated the safety net programs, SNAP benefits, and Medicaid. It bolstered detention and deportation efforts, and it increased spending on defense. Trump called it big and beautiful. Democrats, none of whom voted for it, called it an abomination. It was a rare legislative exercise for the president, who has relied for the most part on executive orders to reconfigure everything from diversity initiatives, and to trade and immigration policy. These orders have been met with hundreds of legal challenges. The Supreme Court has sided with the administration in many of those challenges, but the president has disagreed with lower courts about several rulings having to do with immigration. The DOJ is suing all 15 judges on the federal district court here in Maryland because of temporary holds on deportations. The president has also exercised his power to pardon people quite frequently. In her most recent book, Pardon Power, How the Pardon System Works and Why, the legal scholar and University of Baltimore Law School professor Kim Whaley argues that Mr. Trump's inappropriate use of the pardon power has a devastating effect on our democracy. Indeed, upon taking office, Mr. Trump took less than a day to grant clemency to everybody who was charged or convicted for their participation in the insurrection at the Capitol in 2021. Dozens of those pardoned had prior convictions or were facing charges that include rape, manslaughter, sexual abuse of minors, and drug trafficking. Last week, one of the people Trump pardoned was sentenced to prison for plotting to murder an FBI agent. Today on Midday, Professor Kim Whaley joins me to review some of what the High Court decided this term and analyze what it'll mean for democracy and the rule of law moving forward. Kim Whaley joins us on Zoom. You are welcome to join us as well. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Kim, welcome back. Good to talk to you.
Always great to be with you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And welcome back home to this side of the pond. You've been in the Netherlands on a Fulbright scholarship for most of this year. So I hope that was a productive and fruitful time, and we're delighted to have you back home.
It was an extraordinary experience, yes.
So let's talk about some of the big cases that the Supreme Court decided this year. The first is a case called Trump versus CASA. And this ended up having to do not so much yet with the issue of birthright citizenship, but rather the constitutionality of what's known as universal injunctions. So the president wants to change what the Constitution seems to clearly say about birthright citizenship, but they decided not to take that issue to the court in this case. They took the issue of universal injunctions instead. Can you explain to folks what a universal injunction is, and then what you think of the strategy of bringing that part of this issue to the court rather than the other issue of whether or not if you're born in the United States, you're automatically a citizen?
So a universal injunction is a name for a court order that binds the government as to the entire country. This has been happening, according to the dissenting opinions in this case, since the early 20th century. It's not new, but it has been used more recently in past years, vigorously with respect to President Biden, for example, some of his policies that were controversial. The idea being, if the government does something wrong, it needs to stop. And it needs to stop as to everyone, not just the people that actually brought the lawsuit. The Supreme Court took this case on an emergency basis, essentially, to take up just the issue of universal injunctions, and went on a detour into English history before the Constitution was even ratified, and said, essentially, back in England, there wasn't a remedy like this where a judge could bind the government this way, so the judges can't do it in 2025 either. I've been critical of this decision, and I think it's frankly been misreported or miscovered as just a procedural technicality, when actually at the end of the day it gave the Trump administration a massive win and effectively a back window to avoiding compliance with the Constitution. Because essentially what the majority held is that in order to stop Trump or any president from violating the Constitution, every person who is affected has to file their very own lawsuit. And that's going to benefit people with money who can afford lawyers, but essentially everybody else will continue to be subject to unconstitutional actions by any administration unless they can file their very own lawsuit. And I think this is a massive win and probably one of the most important decisions in terms of the threats to the rule of law since the immunity ruling last summer in Trump versus United States.
The Solicitor General of the United States, John Sauer, who I believe was at one time Mr. Trump's personal lawyer, is one of his personal lawyers. He's now the Solicitor General. He made statements during oral arguments back in May 15th, and he said that universal injunctions, in other words, a judge in New York can make an injunction about laws that cover the entire country. Sauer argued that they exceed the power granted to the judicial branch by the U.S. Constitution. Here's a little bit of what he said during oral arguments in May.
They operate asymmetrically, forcing the government to win everywhere while the plaintiffs can win anywhere. They invert the ordinary hierarchy of appellate review. They create the ongoing risk of conflicting judgments. They increase the pressures on this court's emergency docket. They create what Justice Powell described as repeated and essentially head-on confrontations between the life-tenured and representative branches of government. And they disrupt the Constitution's careful balancing of the separation of powers.
So what do you make of that argument, Kim Whaley? He says, to begin his laundry list there, that they operate asymmetrically and they force the government to win everywhere, in other words, in all the different courts, while the plaintiffs only have to win in one court. And there are one of the complaints that both Democratic and Republican administrations have had is that people shop the courts. So they take suits to courts that they think will be, supportive of their causes. Is there an asymmetry that's inherently unfair? According to Mr. Sauer, there is.
Well, there's always appeals when government doesn't like orders by lower federal court judges. And certainly this Supreme Court is happy to jump in willy-nilly, frankly, and stop lower court orders even without full briefing and oral argument. So I think the government's protected in that regard. But just think of it as a matter of logic. Say you've got, the government builds some factory for whatever reason, or condones the building of a factory that's belching pollution next to your house. You live next to the factory, you sue, and you get an order telling the government to stop. Everybody else in the neighborhood benefits from the order telling the government to close the factory. And the majority admits that's what happens in these court orders, because The order binds the defendant. It's about stopping the defendant's bad behavior. It's not about benefiting the plaintiff in particular. And there's, you know, a statute called the Administrative Procedure Act. That is how lots of people sue the government. Every time there's a court order under the Administrative Procedure Act, that binds the government as to the entire country. So I just think that doesn't make sense as a matter of just how litigation works. And the majority acknowledges that there's people that benefit from court orders. I would also note here that the idea that the big bad wolf are the federal judges ignores the reality of this court order. This executive order, which you mentioned, Tom. Multiple federal judges and appeals courts have held the birthright citizenship order is a blatant violation of the plain language of the Constitution, and a Supreme Court case from the late 1800s that rejected the Trump arguments get a workaround for birthright citizenship. So in this moment, it essentially means anybody who's affected by that executive order has to get a lawyer and bring their very own lawsuit, which would burden the courts. You're talking about hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people that now all have to get their own court order unless they can use the court left open the possibility of class actions. But that's really burdensome. We can talk about that. That's even more difficult than doing what's happened in the lower courts here. So this is a message to Donald Trump. You can do whatever you want when it comes to the Constitution, and it's going to be very hard to get a federal court to stop you because now you have to have so many individuals win to the point where it just becomes too difficult for you to continue these illegal actions.
Kim Whaley is a law professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law and an author. Her latest book is called Pardon Power, How the Pardon System Works and Why. It's midday on the Law, 410-662-8780 to get involved in our conversation, or you can drop us an email, midday@wypr.org. So, Kim, where do things stand then with the argument about birthright citizenship? Has that now been kicked back to the lower courts? It's expected that the Supreme Court will, in fact, make a decision about that issue in the fall when the new term begins. Is that your understanding? How do you see this playing out over the next few months?
Well, the Supreme Court stayed its own order for 30 days, so we're sort of in a holding pattern until July 27th, at which point we'll have to see what the Trump administration does in terms of implementing its unconstitutional birthright citizenship executive order. What the court technically did, though, was say, okay, this goes back to the lower courts to narrow their injunction, to consider if there's a way to just protect the plaintiffs and not have it affect people that are not parties to the actual lawsuits. There are 22 states that are parties, that are plaintiffs to these lawsuits. Those states have said, listen, we're affected by it. We're affected by it financially. We could have people coming across our borders either to avoid the birthright citizenship or to benefit from it, because only 22 of us have actually sued. So I think there's a question as to whether those state court injunctions, how broad those are. But as I said, I'm not so sure that in this moment, the Trump administration doesn't just feel authorized to start actually enforcing its executive order. I don't anticipate that, given kind of how unnecessary this was on an emergency basis, how the court didn't find a need to bring up universal injunctions, and the Biden administration scheduled an oral argument after its term had ended. I mean, all these kind of reaching out extraordinarily to help Donald Trump, this Supreme Court majority. I don't think birthright citizenship and these executive orders are in any meaningful way going to be threatened moving forward. I think we have to expect, as a practical matter, that they're going to go into effect.
Is the fact that the Trump administration is suing 15 judges on the district court here in the state of Maryland, there were injunctions about deporting people that were issued from several different states, but the Trump administration, the DOJ, has gone after an entire bench, an entire group of judges here in the state of Maryland. That strikes me as a non-legal person as incredibly unprecedented. I just don't recall judges being sued by the Justice Department because they issued rulings that the Justice Department was displeased with. Is there any precedent for that, taking the actual judges to court?
Well, Tom, we've talked a lot about immunity for presidents, which the majority created out of whole cloth last summer. But there, for a long time, there's been immunity for judges. You can't sue judges. I haven't looked at that complaint. But you can't sue judges over their decisions, because if you did that, then there wouldn't be this kind of independence. The judges would be worried about themselves, and they wouldn't rule in a way that's consistent with the law and the facts. It would be about self-preservation. But I'm not that surprised, in part because not only is the Supreme Court green-lighted unconstitutional actions. I mean, you know, the fact that the court just didn't even talk about birthright citizenship and a blatant constitutional violation. But the Supreme Court is also green-lighted ignoring lower court, federal court orders. You probably heard this week, it's the second time the Supreme Court allowed Donald Trump, the Trump administration, to send 8 people to South Sudan, which is a place that is in, a political violent conflict now for 5 years. About half of its residents are at the risk of starvation in this moment. They've had a cholera epidemic. But the court basically allowed, and we've seen this week that those people are now being sent to South Sudan, these 8 people to be sent without due process. And in that case, there were multiple federal court injunctions at the lower level that the Trump administration just ignored. So this Supreme Court is essentially undertaking an attack on its brethren, its brothers and sisters in the lower federal courts, saying that, you know, listen, we're going to have the back of the president, not the other federal judges. And we're going to allow violations of court orders. We're going to allow violations of the Constitution. We're going to allow violations in that South Sudan case of international law, a treaty or a convention that the U.S. is a party to. We're going to allow violations of federal statutes without even addressing whether, you know, these laws. That's, I think, a signal to the Trump administration that it can do what it wants. And there's certainly, in this moment, doesn't seem to be any meaningful check and balance that would disincentivize something as unprecedented, as you indicate, as just suing federal judges for doing their jobs. And meanwhile, we have members of the Republican Party in Congress filing impeachment articles against federal judges for doing their jobs. This is bad for every American. Republican, Democrat, independent, non-voter, you want the federal courts to be able to call balls and strikes when it's your turn to be bullied by the government or your turn to be bullied by another private party or a big corporation. You want those judges to be able to assess the facts and the law and to have the appellate courts have their back so that you can be protected. That's why I say this is such a threat to the rule of law, and it's not political, even though it's being distorted as such.
And of course, much of this began with the case of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, who's from Maryland. He's El Salvadoran national who's was living in Maryland with permission, and he's now under arrest in Tennessee. And the Trump administration is saying that as soon as he's released from jail there, he's been arrested there on other charges not related to his immigration status, but his fate remains quite unknown, because once he's released from prison or from jail, the Trump administration says they're going to deport him immediately. And again, that's what these injunctions have to do with. So it's a very messy situation. And as you say, it's a very scary situation. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and talk about some more of the other big decisions that came down this year in the 24-25 season of the Supreme Court. It's Midday on the Law. My guest is Kim Whaley. Her latest book is called Pardon Power: How the Pardon System Works and Why. Kim's a professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law. She's also a legal commentator for ABC News and the host and author of the Simple Politics Substack and IGTV series. We'll have more with Kim Whaley on the other side of a quick break. You can join us at 410-662-8780 or email midday@wipr.org. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the show tomorrow, it's a delight for word nerds. It's Midday on Grammar with Ellen Jovan. Lots of fun when Ellen stops by. She's the grammar guru and the author of Rebel with a Clause, which has been made into a documentary film. She'll join me to answer your questions about what's allowed, what's not allowed, and what's kind of, sort of, sometimes allowed, depending on the situation. So give us a call. And full disclosure, be prepared to compete for absolutely no fabulous prizes. We're not going to have prizes, but we're going to have a lot of fun. Midday on Grammar. That's tomorrow. And if you've just joined us today, my guest is the legal scholar and author Kim Whaley. We're talking about the Supreme Court and the exercise of executive power in the first half year of the Trump administration. Kim's latest book is called Pardon Power, How the Pardon System Works and Why. You can join us at 410-662-8780 or email midday@wipr.org. So, Kim, another case that attracted a lot of attention has to do with treatment for transgender minors. The court ruled that, and it was a divided opinion here against 6-3, the conservative bloc voting against the liberal bloc, a Tennessee law that disallows gender transition medical care for minors. The argument was that this violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, but the court saw it differently. Can you maybe explain a little bit about the intricacies of this case and what you think?
Yeah, so the Equal Protection Clause and this idea of equality under the law hinges on what lawyers call the level of scrutiny. It's essentially what the grading rubric is for what the government did. So things based on, say, if the government does something based on race, they have to have a really, really good reason. That's called strict scrutiny. They have to have a very strong justification. The intermediate scrutiny is in the middle for gender, for example. You have to have a medium-sized justification. And then for everything else, it's called rational basis, which, as I tell my students, if you can throw the spaghetti on the wall and one strand sticks, the government's policy goes into effect. So here, Tennessee banned puberty blockers and hormone therapy for transgender teens, but does allow it for teens that have, you know, overstimulated hormones and develop really early. And so the plaintiffs argued that by allowing it for certain teens but not for other teens, that's a distinction based on gender, and actually argued for a high level of scrutiny here, strict scrutiny. The devil's all in the scrutiny here, Tom. The majority said no. This is not about gender. This is about medicine. And when the government makes a distinction based on medical care, and this wasn't about gender or sex, this is about, you know, different kinds of needs for gender, hormone therapy or puberty blockers, then it gets rational basis. And under rational basis, Tennessee's law can go forward.
And of course, these puberty blockers are sometimes prescribed for kids who are not transitioning or not transgender. So the argument is that this is based on sex because you're disallowing it for one group and you're allowing it for another group. And there are some, I think, 20 states or more than 20 states that have laws similar to what's in effect in Tennessee. So this, again, will have very, very significant implications. I want to talk about another case called Mahmoud versus Taylor, and this happened here in Montgomery County in Maryland. It allows parents to opt out if their child is in public school, and there are themed storybooks that have to do with LGBTQ plus themes. This is in, again, Montgomery County, Maryland, and the justices decided that these children may not, or the schools may not require these children to participate in those lessons if the books conflict with their parents' religious beliefs. Again, a 6-3 decision, the conservative majority, you know, prevailing in this case. What do you make of this one, Kim?
Yeah, so this is also, I think, pushing the law a little bit. There's a case called Wisconsin versus Yoder that does protect parents' ability to decide on the religious education of their kids. For example, you can't compel a child as a public school to take the Pledge of Allegiance. Here, the court basically unveiled a slightly new test that says if what the government or the school is trying to do substantially interferes with the religious development of your child, then you can opt out here. And Justice Alito wrote that these books were unmistakably normative, that is, trying to indoctrinate kids with, they had titles like Born Ready about a transgender elementary age child, or one called Prince and Knight, K-N-I-G-H-T, telling a story of a prince, a male who falls in love and marries another male, a knight. And in the, again, in the dissent, they say, listen, this opens up this Pandora's box now. If it's really about just interfering with religious development, what about if your religion thinks women should stay at home and there's a story about a female astronaut? Or what if your religion bans the eating of meat and the story has something about a hamburger in it? There are 370 different religions represented in Montgomery County, I think the most in the entire country, and 47 million students across the entire United States. Is this going to mean you can't have books about wizards and witches? Or you can't have a child do, a story about my family that goes on the wall in the classroom, because when that child's family is a lesbian couple, the parents are lesbian, for example. And they also argue this is just pragmatically not realistic to implement, because you know, for schools to have an alternative care mechanism, and just the logistics of this and class to class and lesson to lesson is going to be a nightmare, and learning is going to suffer. I think they're probably right from a pragmatic standpoint, what the implications of this mean.
And how much does pragmaticism need to play into the legal determinations of the Supreme Court or any court? The fact that this is virtually impossible to implement, it would seem. Can justices say, well, since we can't enforce it, it's allowable? I mean, does that matter much from a legal standpoint, whether or not the law is implementable?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I really appreciate it, because I think a lot of people, you know, and I see this even with first-year law students, don't understand that the Constitution's really squishy and vague. All it says, it talks about, is religious expression, freedom of religion. It doesn't have any of these other criteria in it. Same thing with unreasonable searches and seizures, or freedom of speech. There's just no definitions. And so the courts use all kinds of criteria. They'll look at plain language. They'll look at dictionaries. They'll look at the policy rationales, the workability of it. This majority goes back to, as we talked about earlier, you know, the kings of England before there even was a United States, to try to hammer out how to interpret an ambiguous term. So absolutely, the pragmatic element of it is important. And some would say, because of that, judges should not be tinkering a whole lot with some of these rules, because it makes it very difficult then for the elected branches of government, that is the states and the school boards, and those that are charged through an electoral process with actually educating public school students, leaves them with a big mess. And the Supreme Court justices aren't elected, and they can't be fired at the ballot box anymore. They can be hired at the ballot box. So this is a criticism that goes both ways against the conservative-leaning courts and progressive-leaning courts. But the point is that there's no one way to interpret the Constitution. And when people argue that the conservatives are doing it with more fidelity to a legitimate way of reading ambiguous language than justices who look at the policy implications, that's just not true. That's flatly inaccurate. All of them judge. That's the point of judging.
Exactly.
They make judgments.
Yeah, that's why they're called judges, as it turns out. Yeah. Kim Whaley is my guest. She's on the faculty of the University of Baltimore School of Law. She's the author of her most latest book, Pardon Power, How the Pardon System Works and Why. You can join our conversation about the Supreme Court, about executive power, 410-662-8780, our email midday at WIPR.org. Got a couple of emails from listeners. Annette in Bel Air, talking about immigration, says a lot of this is the brainchild of Stephen Miller, and that is absolutely true. He is the deputy chief of staff and the architect of the immigration policy for the Trump administration. Ned from Baltimore emails, I appreciate the legal insights of Kim Whaley, but you'd think that the GOP would worry that these individual rulings by the court giving Trump so much power would also apply to any future Democratic president. And he goes on to say, if you've read Project 2025, they're not worried because the plan is to never have another Democrat elected president. But does this open the door for abuse, if that's what we want to call it, from the standpoint of people on the political right? Does it open the door to allow similar kinds of things for people on the left? What do you think?
Yeah, if there isn't a president who's a Democrat in the future, they have this kind of unfettered, unlimited power that Donald Trump is exercising in this moment. I mean, I like to think about it, you know, when you think about the revolutionaries who fought to kick out a bullying king, King George III, that's the point of our democracy and our Constitution. No more kings. If you're under a system where you've got somebody in power that really has no restraints, which I think is where we are right now in the United States, you have to hope for a benevolent king, not a malevolent king. And so in the future, I think if there is a Democrat, maybe we can hope that they'll just, you know, abide by some kind of internal metric of, an internal value system or some respect for the rule of law, knowing that if they decide to disrespect the rule of law or violate it, there's nothing anybody can really do about it, because that's really where the Supreme Court and the GOP has put us, and the voters, frankly, who went to the ballot in November of 24 and voted for this kind of regime. That's where we are right now.
And you and I talked about this in regard to the pardon power when President Biden, right before the end of his term, pardoned his son and various other family members and pardoned a bunch of people preemptively. And there are a lot of legal scholars, and I think you are among them, who disagreed, you know, with that use of the pardon power, which, of course, is uncontestable in court. It is a pardon, or is a power that resides exclusively in the hands of who's ever president. So, to a certain extent, we've seen this already happen before, just this year.
Well, I was actually one of the few that was not critical of the Hunter Biden pardons for reasons we can talk about. But certainly this idea of pardoning his family members who didn't even have, as far as I know, any kind of legal liability that we were aware of. This kind of slow drip, drip, drip accretion of power in the presidency has been going on for decades. There's been some debate about, you know, bombing Iran. The power to declare war is lodged in the Constitution in Congress, but Congress has ceded that for decades now. So it matters less, Tom, about what the Constitution says and more about whether we care to enforce the Constitution, just like a speed limit. People will speed. The sign doesn't slow you down. The ticket slows you down. And there are no real tickets for speeding in the White House anymore. And it's not just Donald Trump, but he has done that on steroids as promised. But certainly presidents before him have pushed the needle, and Congresses from both sides of the aisle have allowed it.
And we have a caller, John, who's in Baltimore. John, welcome to the program, Midday on the Law with Kim Whaley.
Thank you, Tom. My question is based on my opinion That it seems to me that Donald Trump has, through at least two actions that I can think of, broken his oath of office. The second part of the oath of office says, and I'm reading from it now, and will do to the best of my ability, will to the best of my ability preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. And his not providing or seeming to block or ignoring some immigrants' rights to due process, I think, is one example. And the other is how he has challenged one of the amendments to the Constitution concerning birthright citizenship.
Yeah, well, thanks for that perspective, John. And Kim, is this, as you were just saying, simply a matter of Mr. Trump's understanding of the Constitution being different than many other people?
No, I mean, I completely agree with the caller. And you mentioned my Substack. I did a post, I think it was this week or last week, that listed all the places of the Constitution that have been ignored, not just the ones the caller mentioned, but also the Emoluments Clause, the Appropriations Clause. You mentioned due process. You could say the Sixth Amendment, the Fourth Amendment. I mean, on and on and on. But you know who else takes that oath? It's the Supreme Court justices. And they're not upholding the plain language of the Constitution either, as far as I'm concerned, based on some of the stuff we've talked about. They're allowing the president to override the Constitution. Again, it's not about what the Constitution says. It's about whether there are any mechanisms to enforce the Constitution. And last summer, again, in that immunity ruling, Article 2, in addition to the oath, as the caller mentioned, Article 2 says the president shall take care that the laws are faithfully executed, shall take care that the laws are faithfully executed. The Supreme Court said, unless it's criminal laws, basically said that he can violate criminal laws at the same time he's required, mandated to faithfully execute the laws. That's not intellectually honest to even hold those ideas in your head. And Chief Justice Roberts didn't even talk about the take care clause in his decision manufacturing criminal immunity. We need to have a conversation in this country, not just about Donald Trump, but about the United States Supreme Court, because a lot of what's going on the court, I think because of the just traditional warranted respect for the court, is not being debated. It's not being named. It's being kind of dressed up as legal, just, you know, arguments that won the day, procedural maneuvering. But it's really radical what's going on in this U.S. Supreme Court, and it's turning us away from democracy and into something that in this moment, and I'm just paraphrasing colleagues of mine who have expertise in this, looks a lot like authoritarianism or autocracy and not democracy.
Yeah, and you wrote in your Substack, we are now the closest this country has ever been to a monarchy since its birth. Authoritarianism, a monarchy, are they the same?
Yeah, experts will debate that. Some say we're technically an autocracy. Some very, very well-known experts have used the word fascism. I think, the jargon is less important than, again, the question, what are the tickets for speeding? Is impeachment realistic right now? No. If the Democrats take control of the House of Representatives in the midterm, can they do anything to stop him? What are they going to do? Start impeachment? That won't go anywhere. They're going to pass some new laws? He's ignoring the ones that exist. They're going to hold hearings? Is that going to stop him? This is about disincentivizing illegality. Where is the ticket for speeding? Where is it? I don't see it. So for that, that's why I say it looks like a monarchy. And if somebody can point out what's going to slow this administration down in accumulating unlimited power to bully not just migrants, but other people that should care about this, I would love to hear it because we are in a red light moment otherwise.
It's Midday on the Law. Kim Whaley is my guest. She's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. She's a legal commentator for ABC News and the host and author of the Substack and IGTV series Simple Politics. Her latest book is Pardon Power, How the Pardon System Works and Why. We'll have more with Kim Whaley after a quick break. You can join us when we come back, 410 662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is the legal scholar, author, and television commentator Kim Whaley. She's on the faculty of the University of Baltimore School of Law. She's a frequent contributor to The Bulwark, Politico, and at The Atlantic. Her latest book is Pardon Power: How the Pardon System Works and Why. Last July, the Supreme Court ruled that presidents can act with impunity and immunity from criminal prosecution for official acts while in office. That broad protection, combined with the power to pardon others for criminal acts, represents a devastating blow to the fundamental underpinnings of our democracy. When the Supreme Court reconvenes in the fall, they'll take up several important cases, including the constitutionality of birthright citizenship and state laws that restrict transgender athletes from participating in women's sports. Kim Whaley joins us on Zoom. You are welcome to join us as well. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And let's go back to the phones to Derek in Baltimore. And Derek, I understand you are a former student of Professor Whaley. Is that right?
That is correct, Tom.
Well, welcome
hey,
to the show.
Hi, Professor Whaley. Thanks so much for taking my call. Just a quick question with regard to the universal injunction case and what will likely be a line of cases. During Supreme Court oral argument, and I've heard this discussed, in addition to the potential class action remedy, there's also been discussion of, I guess, state attorneys general or other suits that might be coming forward in the future. I was wondering if you could comment on that particular avenue for a release.
Yeah, thanks for that question. So you mentioned class actions, and I said that's a steeper hill, but there's apparently at least one federal judge who's already used that class action mechanism to restrain a Trump policy. I think it was Justice Thomas or Justice Alito in dissent when their concurring opinions were very skeptical of the use of Rule 23, which is the class action, because there's a multi-step process just to even initiate a class action. It's meant to be harder to do than just a routine lawsuit. The second thing I mentioned, the Administrative Procedure Act, they left that open. That would require the Trump administration to issue a written policy on how they're going to implement the birthright citizenship order. And then that policy possibly could be challenged under the APA. And the APA always ends up with a universal injunction. My guess is that the lawyers for the Trump administration will know how to draft that policy in a way to evade APA review. And then the last piece, there were 22 states that are already parties to some of these actions. The states have said, listen, it doesn't help us to only say that the 14th Amendment applies in our state, and then it doesn't apply in other states, because say the 14th Amendment birthright citizenship applies in, you know, state of Aurora, but it doesn't apply in the states neighboring the state of Aurora. Everybody in the neighboring states, or a lot of people, are going to want to move to Aurora, whose birthright citizenship depends on the 14th Amendment, because without it, they have no other place to go to in the planet. They don't have a home state because their country was America under the 14th Amendment. So Aurora, the state's going to say, listen, we need this universal injunction because otherwise it's unworkable for us. We'll have this influx essentially of refugees. You need the Constitution to apply to the entire country, not just our state. So I do think that is going to create some complexities for the Supreme Court. But in the interim, we're going to see, I think, as I said earlier, the Trump administration really lean in to this executive order.
Well, thank you for that call, Derek. And do I have it right that you are a judge at this point?
Correct. I'm an administrative law judge here in Baltimore County.
Well, great. Well, thank you for calling, and we're happy to provide this opportunity for professional development right here on Midday, and we appreciate it.
Congratulations. That makes my day to have a student in that position. That's really amazing.
That's great. We have an email from Richard who says, earlier this morning on NPR, there was an interview with a conservative legal scholar who claimed that the judges in Maryland deserve to be sued because they've been overreaching their authority. This overreach business, this activist judge, condemnation that we've heard for years from sometimes the right and the left. That's one of those places where, the Constitution is pretty vague in a lot of its language. Who decides what's an overreach and who decides what's allowed? This is really coming to a head in a particularly acute way in this administration. I mean, in the first administration of Trump, he petitioned the court 41 times to overturn the rulings of lower courts, and he won 28 of those cases. So there, if he's playing the percentages, generally speaking, he's winning.
Well, Tom, I just said, the overreach is on the part of the Trump administration and, frankly, the Supreme Court. That's propaganda, and I don't use that word lightly. Federal district court judges are subject to appeals, and they actually, their jurisdiction is created by Congress. Congress creates all the lower federal courts. It decides how big the Supreme Court is. Under the Constitution, the only judge that is mandated is probably Chief Justice Roberts in the entire country. So the federal judges actually have authority both under statutory law as well as historical precedent. And just what happened in the universal injunction case itself, if there's a belief that they overreach, the answer is not to attack them on X and to impeach them, but to file appeals. And that's what the Trump administration is doing successfully in this moment.
We have less than a minute left. I want to ask you about something you've written about on Substack, and that is the actions of ICE. Your take overall as to whether or not these raids with the ICE agents masked and sometimes, in unmarked uniforms, unmarked cars, et cetera, is that legal? Is it lawful?
Well, I've looked into this, and this is one of the areas where we don't have a lot of law protecting citizens, because I think the expectation until this moment has been that the government acts in good faith. So the law has not developed in a way to second guess most federal law enforcement officials. So in terms of, for the most part, ICE not identifying themselves or, wearing, using unmarked cars without badges, there's not a lot of protections for citizens. Now, there is reporting that these people are going places we don't know where they are going. It's not just Kilmar or Borrego Garcia. There's over 200 that are in El Salvador that are still there, and we don't know if they're there legally. That's a different story. And as far as what happened in California, the lower federal court judge said that it was overreach in pulling out the National Guard. The Ninth Circuit actually sided with the Trump administration. But none of that would have been necessary but for these raids. We've never seen this kind of massive ICE enforcement efforts, and people are getting upset, and that's understandable. So if we want to stop all this chaos, the way to stop it is in the White House, frankly.
And Congress just approved $150 billion for these kinds of activities to ramp up even higher. So
it's going to change America. It's going to change America, Tom.
Kim Whaley, she is on the faculty of the University of Baltimore School of Law. Her latest book is called Pardon Power, How the Pardon System Works and Why. Thank you, Kim. Really appreciate it.
Always great to be with you, Tom.
And that's it for us today. Tomorrow it's Midday on Grammar. Join us for that. Up next, at the top of the hour, Fresh Air. The guest today, Rafael Sadiq. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.
This is 88.1 WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.